From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's archive edition of Fresh Air, children's book author Maurice Sendak remembers his own childhood. He explored the terrors of childhood in his classic books Where the Wild Things Are and In the Night Kitchen. His new book, We're All in the Dumps with Jack and Guy, is about homeless kids, and it's adapted from a nursery rhyme. Also today, an acting lesson from the great actor Michael Caine. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Israeli police shot and killed a man they say was a military commander in the Islamic militant group Hamas. Police say they shot Khalid al-Zeir in the Arab section of East Jerusalem. They said the 24-year-old Palestinian shot at them as he attempted to escape. Zeir was described as a suspect in the killings of a Jewish settler and two Israeli soldiers, as well as a number of Arabs accused of collaborating with the Israelis. The killing came 2 days after Palestinians rioted in the West Bank to protest the killing of another man described as a top Hamas commander. UN relief efforts in Bosnia have been frustrated again, despite recent assurances from all warring sides that they'd stop interfering. Aid convoys into central Bosnia have been blocked just 3 days after they were resumed, and the evacuation of hundreds of civilians from Sarajevo has been postponed. From Zagreb, Richard Carruthers reports.
In northern Bosnia, a series of aid convoys were halted at a Serb checkpoint, despite having clearance from local authorities they could pass. The Serb commander claims snow and rocks make the road too dangerous. The UN thinks he's lying. It says another convoy has recently used the same route without problems. Ironically, one of the trucks now stranded is carrying fuel for a mental hospital in Serb-held territory. In the besieged capital Sarajevo, an operation to evacuate more than 1,000 women, children, and sick people was postponed just as they were boarding buses. Croat forces have reportedly demanded that one of their commanders be released before they'll allow the evacuees, who are from all ethnic groups, to cross into neighboring Croatia. For National Public Radio, this is Richard Carruthers in Zagreb.
The French agriculture minister says that progress has been made toward a world trade agreement. This is his first positive public statement on the general agreement on tariffs and trade in a month. Lynn Terry reports from Paris.
Agriculture Minister Jean Puech said in an interview with a Paris-based newspaper that Washington might agree to exclude grain stocks from farm subsidy cuts in a future GATT accord. At the moment, the stocks would be counted in subsidy cuts in a farm trade deal signed between the United States and the EC that France is contesting. Disagreement over the deal is partly responsible for blocking a GATT accord. Washington has refused to renegotiate the agreement, but Puech said he thought on the grain issue, France and Washington are now not far apart. His statement is the first by a French official indicating a breakthrough in the GATT talks. Similar optimism has also been expressed by the European Commission following the EC-US trade talks this week. For National Public Radio, this is Lynn Terry in Paris.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average lost about 4 points to close at 3,684. This is NPR. Germany has cracked down on Kurds in the country, banning several Kurdish organizations and raiding Kurdish homes and offices. The actions follow a recent series of coordinated attacks on Turkish buildings in Germany and across Europe. The Kurdistan Workers' Party, a group fighting for independence from Turkey, is widely blamed for the attacks. Despite today's actions against Kurdish groups, German Foreign Minister Klaus Kinkel says Germany will continue to pressure Turkey to improve its treatment of Kurdish people. The BBC's Diana Goodman reports from Berlin.
Mr. Kinkel said the government had decided it must take action against militant Kurdish groups after a new round of attacks on Turkish targets here earlier this month. He said that Germany had obligations towards Turkey, which was another member of NATO. But he stressed that at the same time the government had much understanding for what he described as the justified demands of the suffering Kurdish people. As a result, he said, Germany planned to maintain a critical dialogue on human rights issues with the authorities in Ankara. The statement by Mr. Kinkel is seen as an attempt to persuade Kurdish extremists not to take action against German targets in retaliation for the ban on their organizations. In the past, the PKK has described Germany as enemy number two, second only to Turkey, and there's concern that German politicians could now be singled out.
Diana Goodman in Berlin. New Jersey Democrats said today that they have not seen sufficient evidence to overturn the Republican victory in the state's gubernatorial election. The New Jersey Democratic State Committee investigated allegations that Republicans offered charitable contributions to black ministers if they would not encourage their congregations to vote. An attorney for the Democrats spoke today after a deposition given by Webster Todd, the brother of Republican Governor-elect Christy Whitman. Todd repeatedly denied any knowledge of any such payments. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. If you remember childhood as a place that included complicated emotions, where monsters lurked, and where sadness and fear sometimes kept you awake at night, then you have a friend and children's book author and illustrator Maurice Sendak. His books, which include Where the Wild Things Are, In the Night Kitchen, and Outside Over There, bring to life an unsentimental view of childhood. His new book, We Are All in the Dumps with Jack and Guy, is Sendak's first children's book that isn't about middle-class kids. We're All in the Dumps is set in an urban landscape and deals with homelessness, sickness, and hunger. It's based on two English nursery rhymes. I asked him to recite them.
We are all in the dumps for diamonds or trumps. The kittens are gone to St. Paul's. The babies are bit, the moon's in a fit, and the houses are built without walls. That's the first one. Second one. Jack and Guy went out in the rye, and they found a little boy with one black eye. Come, says Jack, let's knock him on the head. No, says Guy, let's buy him some bread. You buy one loaf and I'll buy two, and we'll bring him up as other folk do.
The first rhyme that you recited,
mm-hmm.
I wouldn't have known what to make of it. I'd have to say it wouldn't have made any sense to me. You want to recite it one more
sure.
time?
Well, see, there are clues in it for an illustrator. We are all in the dumps
mm-hmm.
for diamonds or trumps. The kittens are gone to St. Paul's. The babies are bit. The moon's in a fit. And the houses are built without walls. Now, I think it's extraordinarily beautiful poetry, but it's like haiku. What does it mean? Well, I'm faced with a bridge game, diamonds or trumps. That means somewhere in this book, somebody's playing bridge. Not being a card player, that doesn't turn me on. So I had to learn how to play bridge. The moon's in a fit. You have to figure out why the moon is in a fit. What does it mean? The kittens are gone to St. Paul's. I mean, what does St. Paul's mean to American children primarily? And then the astonishing, extraordinary line, the houses are built without walls. I mean, that's what moved me all these years to make this work for me.
So what did that come to mean to you, the houses are built without walls?
It meant, finally, kids who have no place to live. This really started back in Los Angeles, or at least one detail, and a significant one, began in Los Angeles years ago. I was working on an opera, the LA Opera, and we came home late from a rehearsal, and I was driven back to my hotel, and we passed down some very, very posh streets in Beverly Hills. Maybe it was Rodeo Drive, but I couldn't swear to it. And there, past midnight, on the street, in this posh section of town, was just a dilapidated, ruined cardboard box with two dirty, naked kids' feet sticking out. The juxtaposition was astonishing. It's as though when everybody stopped shopping and gone home, then these kids came out, or people came out, and every city is ringed round with shantytowns, homeless. We all know that. We have it in New York. We have it in every major metropolis in this country. But it astonished me to see that juxtaposition. I got interested, and I got a book on Rio de Janeiro, and discovered that there is a ringed round, well-known shantytown, kids' town around the city. And kids are abandoned. A little girl sold into prostitution. Little boys run away from abuse, from being abused at home. And they make their own cities. And they're as cruel to each other as any adults can be. And their lives are very, very brief. And they live in tin cans and cardboard houses and rag huts. And I suddenly began to see what dumps is. We are all in the dumps. Back in the 60s, that, of course, meant, you know, if you're in therapy, dumps means you're in a depression, which is probably why I couldn't make anything sound out of it back then. Now dumps literally means the world. We are all in the dumps is really well describes events around the world at this point.
Your new book deals with some real world fears like homelessness mm-hmm. and being scared by what could happen to you as a kid now. What were the real big events in your life that you found really frightening when you were young?
When I was young, the big events were being sick and being expected to die and knowing that at a very early age, I might. This was spoken. My parents were very indiscreet. My parents came from a foreign country. They were immigrants. They didn't know about Freud. They didn't know about what to say or not to say in front of children. So, and they loved us, me, my brother, and my sister, but that I suffered a good deal from very severe illnesses, not untypical of 30s children when there were no sulfa drugs and there wasn't penicillin. And you went through all the dire illnesses, and sometimes you just croaked. So it was the awareness at a very early age of mortality which pervaded my soul, apparently, and I think provided me with the basic ingredients of being an artist. That was critical. And knowing that I was vulnerable and that other children were vulnerable.
What did you have? What diseases?
Oh, you know, scarlet fever and pneumonia twice and whooping cough and chicken pox. It was the pneumonia and the scarlet fever that really nearly did me in.
Were you carefully watched over by your parents
when
you were sick? I
was so carefully watched over. They practically killed me with watching over me. So I was delicate. I was very delicate. And I was not allowed to participate in street games. And so that a lot of my early childhood was immediately spent in inventing and imagining. And happily, I had superb, and still have, thank God, siblings. My brother, who is 5 years old, has spent a lot of time with me, that he might have spent having fun outside in the street, drawing pictures for me and telling me stories, as did my sister, as did my parents. And so I was well provided for in terms of human companionship. But it left a very severe mark.
In those days when you were sick and everybody was worried about you dying, did you have any sense of what death was?
I don't remember that. But I do remember I was a very close companion to death. And I remember a game my father played with me, which you would not exactly call a death game, but did move in that direction, which was that if I lay in bed, which I spent a lot of time doing, and I remember in one particular place we lived in Brooklyn, we moved quite frequently because of financial problems, and just opposite the foot of my bed was a window looking out in the backyard facing a just very boring brick wall. And he said, if you looked and didn't blink, if you saw an angel, you'd be a very, very lucky child. And so I did that frequently. And of course, I would always blink because it hurt not to blink. And then you didn't see it. And he'd say, well, you blinked, didn't you? And I say, yes. And I remember once I didn't blink and I saw it. Or I imagined I saw it, but the memory of it is so vivid I could even describe it to you.
Would you?
Well, I was lying in the bed, obviously, staring out the window, my eyelids aching, my eyes aching, staring, 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 and something very large, like almost like a dirigible. But it wasn't a dirigible because it was right past my window. It was a slow-moving angel. She, he, whatever, moved very gracefully and slowly, coming from left, going across to right, not turning to observe me at all. I don't have a memory of the face, but I remember a memory of the hair, the body, and the wings. It took my breath away. It just moved so slowly that I could examine it quite minutely. And then I shrieked and hollered, and my father came in. I said, I saw it. And he said, I was a very lucky kid. You will have noticed angels and we are all in the dumps. I love angels. I'm about to say obsessed. That's hyperbole. I'm not obsessed with angels, but I do adore angels. I've never drawn them in a book, and they do appear in the new book, primarily because so many people have died recently that I have populated my book with their spirits floating around. And they're all reading the New York Times because I can't imagine. Even up there, you got to figure out what's going on every day.
So when you saw the angel, did you think that that was a sign that you were going to live or that something wonderful was going to happen?
I think it put me in alliance with death things, with important things. I can't really describe it. I really can't tell you what it meant. It's a very internal feeling, but it came out of such a complex awareness as a child of the fragility of life. There is a story which I can't prove, but I was told that at a very early age, my parents dressed me. It's a religious custom or superstition from the old country. They dressed me all in white from top to toe so that if God is watching, he would have thought me already an angel and he would not pluck me. And I wouldn't die, in other words. I would be a fraudulent angel. This is a superstition, and it does occur in old villages in the old country. I don't know that it happened to me. But it's significant that it was a family story, so that it told me how forcefully they were concerned about me.
Did you see your parents as being really capable parents who could help fend off death or fend off whatever other problems that you had?
No, because they were so vulnerable to problems. They caved in on problems all the time. So I did not see them. And this is not a criticism of them. Their lives were extremely hard. But no, I did not see them that way.
Now, they were from Poland?
They were from Poland, yeah.
And they fled before World War I?
Yes, they did, just before World War I. They didn't flee. My father left on a lark.
Oh, well, what was that?
He had no cause to come here. My grandfather was a rabbi. He was the youngest son, and he was obviously the spoiled younger son of my grandmother. And he actually fell in love with a young woman. And it became a little bit scandalous, and she was put on a boat and shipped off to America. And he sulked and pouted and got money out of his siblings and got on another boat to follow her here. And his family was appalled at his behavior. Because of that trivial behavior, he was the only survivor of his entire family. I mean, all of my uncles and aunts and all of the children were destroyed in concentration camps. My father's grief, his entire life, was that his survival was based on such a trivial impulse. It really did cause him a lot of grief, especially when he became older.
You grew up before the Holocaust. Was he still really regretful about
it? Oh, he was terribly regretful and guilty. I mean, he had survivor guilt, as did my mother, who had much less cause, because she was shipped off when she was about 17 to come to America. She was uneducated, untrained in anything. She was a girl. My grandfather, on her side, also a rabbi, had died at a very early age of a coronary, and there was no money to take care of everybody. So she was sent here to do it, to work hard, earn money, and then bring them over, which is typical. She met my father, they married, and all the first income was spent on bringing one aunt, then an uncle, then another uncle, then another aunt, then my grandmother, till finally all but one brother on her side were all here. And then they were going to turn to my father's side, and then it was too late. That was in the 30s. There was no getting Jews out of Europe at that point. And so growing up during the war, that was tough, having to live through that in all its complexity. Colors your life forever.
Did your parents talk to you much about the old country?
Oh, yeah. Thank goodness. And when my father was last year of his life, paradoxically, we had a wonderful time, I took his biography down, which was wonderful. A lot of it was fantasy and a lot of it was reality, but I was...
His biography?
Yeah.
He wrote a biography?
He wrote a biography, which is not published. He did write a fairy tale, which I translated with the help of somebody else and illustrated, and that was published just before his death.
Right.
It's called In Grandpa's House. But his biography is not published, and I don't intend to have it published. It's a private family chronicle. We didn't get much of my mother's life. My mother was silent about that period of her life.
I think as a lot of people from Eastern Europe who came to America were. Did they seem like aliens to you because, I don't know, they're probably, did they speak more Yiddish than English?
Yes, they spoke
the
more Yiddish. I spoke Yiddish as a child. My parents spoke English very, very late and very poorly. And we lived in a part of Brooklyn which was teeming with immigrants, either other people from Eastern Europe, Jews, or Sicilians. And I couldn't tell the difference. I mean, we lived next to the Sicilians, and I had a real, it sounds like coy conceit, but it's a fact. I had a real confusion because right across the hall from us was my best friend at one place we lived, Carmine, and his sisters and brothers and his huge mother and huge father, just across the hall. And I used to run across the hall because they had unkosher food, which is much better, much better than kosher food because it was pasta. It was great Italian cooking. And they laughed and they drank wine and they grabbed me and I sat on their laps and they had a hell of a good time. Then you come back to my house and you have these sober cuisine and not so rambunctious family life. And I really did have a confusion that Italians were happy Jews, that they were a sect.
Oh, that's really interesting.
And that I would have a choice. That I would have a choice after my bar mitzvah to belong to either the sober sect or the happy sect.
And they went to a different synagogue where they had pasta.
Yeah, I was a dumb kid. Let me tell you. I mean, all the parents looked alike. They all wore the same dull black dresses, and you couldn't tell the difference. Not to me.
My guest is children's book author and illustrator Maurice Sendak. His latest book is called We Are All in the Dumps with Jack and Guy. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. Artist Maurice Sendak is with us. One of the great controversies about your book, is, you know, in the night kitchen, when the character Mickey lands in the batter, he's naked, and there's this, like, little boy penis that he has, right?
Yeah.
And there were libraries that wouldn't carry the book or would draw little diapers over him, all kinds of silly things like that. I mean, this was not a sexual image. It was just a naked boy image.
Correct.
Right?
I mean, it would have been strange had he not had a penis.
Right.
But no one has ever discussed that problem.
Right.
The astonishing and infuriating business on that book was that was it's one of my favorite works, and it's a rather complex work. And to have it all reduced, so to speak, to a child's penis is embarrassing and silly. And the fact that anyone could carry on about such an issue does not speak well for our culture.
Well, here's what I'm wondering. Now, that book was not about Mickey as a sexual boy or anything. But I think a lot of kids do have sexual feelings, maybe just a little bit older than Mickey. And I was wondering if you ever thought about putting sexual feelings into a children's book or if that would seem like much too far out.
Well, I have to correct something you say, or at least I don't agree with something you just said, which is that he, little boy in the night kitchen, does not have sexual feelings. Of course he does. We have them immediately on arrival. We may have them in utero. I suspect we probably do, but we just haven't traced that yet. There's nothing, in a word, that you can do that is not sexual, so far as I'm concerned. And the creative act is composed of its sexual component. As animals, which is all that we are, obviously, there's nothing we can do that isn't sexual, thank God. And I don't mean by saying sexual, that is vivid, livid sex. I mean the component of sexuality, sensuality, eroticism is part of everything. And it's what blesses our life. And instead of seeing it in an accusatory way, and I don't mean you, I mean culture in general, or blameworthy way, rather see it for the beautiful thing that it is. We can't do without it.
I remember I interviewed you, I don't know, 8 years ago or something. Something that you said really stuck with me. You were talking about the monsters and where the wild things are, and you were saying that when you were young, the monsters were just adults. There were people with like moles on their faces mm-hmm. and hairs growing out of their noses.
Yeah.
And old
relatives, actually.
Yeah, old relatives, exactly. Relative, exactly. Yeah. And that really struck a chord. And then I started thinking, well, I'm one of those people now. I mean, I don't know if I actually have hair growing out of my nose, but you know, I have some of those things that I'm sure kind of like scare kids.
Oh, sure.
And do you have your sense of yourself as that too?
Of
like,
course.
You know, a monster to some kids?
Of course I am. I see it in their eyes. When I'm autographing books, which I don't like to do much anymore, and children are shoved at me.
Yeah.
They have no idea why they're on the line. They'd much rather be in the bathroom. And they're standing online, and they're being told something which is so frightening and confusing, which is being told by mom or dad. This is the man you like so much, honey. This is the man who did your favorite book. And they clutch their book even closer, because that really means he's going to take it away. Because if this is the man's favorite book, then he's going to take your book. And the look of alarm and the tears, and they stare at me like pure hatred. Who is this elderly, short man sitting behind the desk who's going to take their book away? Then on top of that, the parent says, now give him your book, honey. He wants to write something in it. Well, there they've been told, don't write in a book. Okay? Why then is it all right for a perfect stranger to write in their book? It's horrible for them. And I become horrible. Unwittingly, I make children cry.
They cry when
they cry when they meet me because they don't know what I'm doing. And only when they're, it's quicker with girls because girls are smarter than boys. We all know that. They grow up faster. And girls, by the time they're 7 or 8, already know the business of autographing and what it means. Boys don't till they're about 40, I think. And so they'll pull it away. There's only one child who ever had the courage, and his father was urging him forward. I could see the hesitation. I just felt so bad for the kid, and I put my hand on the book to help draw it away from him, and he literally screamed and said, don't crap up my book. It was the bravest cry I've ever heard. I nearly wept.
So what'd you do?
Well, I took the father aside because I think the father was going to kill the kid because he'd embarrassed him and made everybody laugh. And I had to sit down and say how great I thought his kid was and not to be angry with him because the child just didn't understand what this whole nonsense, this social nonsense of autographing was all about. And it would be criminal to punish him for this.
This is great. Every time you do a book signing, it's kind of like dysfunctional family in America.
That's right. Becomes into psychiatric sessions.
You must feel awful, though. You know, because you're being misunderstood by the kids who love your books.
Well, frankly, that's why I do not visit children in classrooms.
Mm-hmm.
That's why I've stopped autographing for the most part.
Uh-huh.
For that very, very reason, it's such a paradox that I, who adore them and I'm interested in their welfare, should become their enemy. It's only because it's set up that way. If I'm to visit a school, they're all warned, threatened, and browbeaten for 3 days before I get there. Now I want all of you to be nice, and you must raise your hand, and I want everyone to go to the bathroom before Mr. Sendak comes. I mean, their lives are ruined. So why should I be the person who does that to them?
Oh. Maurice Sendak, recorded earlier this year. His latest book is called We Are All in the Dumps with Jack and Guy. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up after Michael Caine. Caine has appeared in more than 70 films, in roles ranging from leading man to a psychotic cross-dressing killer, from a Cockney womanizer to an upper-class con artist. He's worked with John Huston, Brian De Palma, Woody Allen, been in movies that are considered classics, and in movies so bad no one remembers them. We talked to Michael Caine about his life, his choices, and some of the techniques he's used to create the characters he's played. That's coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Laura Kanoy. Israeli authorities say they've killed another member of the military wing of Hamas, the Islamic group opposed to the Israeli PLO peace accord. John Devitt has more from Jerusalem.
Israel Radio said security forces surrounded three houses in an area of Arab East Jerusalem. Everyone was ordered out, and according to the radio, the wanted man tried to flee and was shot dead. Palestinians, though, say the man was unarmed and was killed by undercover soldiers. The Israelis say the dead man was responsible for the killing of one Jewish settler and two soldiers, and that he was a leader of the military wing of the hardline Islamic movement Hamas. This comes 2 days after the killing of a Hamas military leader in the Gaza Strip. The Israeli government is under pressure to show that it can combat an upsurge in attacks by Palestinian militants opposed to the peace deal. But the climate of violence has raised questions about the peace deal among both Palestinians and Israelis. The Palestinians are due to take over responsibility for security in the Gaza Strip and Jericho by mid-December. For National Public Radio, I'm John Devitt in Jerusalem.
PLO Chairman Yasser Arafat is urging Israel to go ahead with plans to withdraw its troops from the occupied Gaza Strip next month. Speaking in Sweden today, Arafat said his forces will do a better job of keeping the peace there. "This is my land, these are my people," he said. "Everything will go smoothly." Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin has warned that growing violence in the territories could delay the troop pullout. Shoppers were out in full force around the country today. In Chicago, economists say although it's not the boom time of the 1980s, sales are expected to be strong this Christmas season. Cheryl Corley of member station WBEZ reports.
People are in the spirit of shopping in the Chicago area, looking for that special something, crowding the malls and the shopping districts. Economists say they expect merchants to ring up sales that match last year's totals, maybe even go up by about 5%. Economist Diane Swonk says most money will be spent on big-ticket items.
I think there's a huge trade-off here between your less traditional kinds of Christmas items, more practical items related to the house and the housing market, and your traditional kinds of Christmas goodies like apparel. The apparel stores will probably not do as well in this environment as your general merchandise stores would sell furniture and appliances.
That analysis is not bothering other retailers, though. They just hope shoppers keep coming in since the holiday season makes for 40% of their annual sales. For National Public Radio, I'm Cheryl Corley in Chicago.
Weather forecasters say the Dakotas could get more snow after 1 to 2 feet fell on the area in the past few days. Icy, snowy weather is blamed for at least 14 deaths today and yesterday. On Wall Street, stocks close mixed today. The Dow Jones Industrials lost nearly 4 points. This is NPR. Germany today banned the Kurdistan Workers' Party, or PKK, and 35 related Kurdish groups. The government declared Germany would not become a battleground for foreign extremists. The move comes after a series of simultaneous attacks on Turkish offices across Germany and Western Europe last month. The PKK was widely blamed for the attacks, although it denies any involvement. The PKK is waging a civil war in Turkey for a separate homeland in the southeast. German police today raided more than 100 Kurdish establishments across the country, searching Kurdish clubs, homes, and businesses. As a major election in Russia approaches, President Boris Yeltsin has threatened to deprive political parties of free access to television if they attack his proposal for a new constitution. NPR's Mike Schuster reports from Moscow.
The referendum referendum on the new constitution takes place the same day, December 12th, as the parliamentary elections. Each of 13 political parties has been given 2 hours of free airtime, and several have used the time to attack Yeltsin's constitution and his handling of the uprising at the old Supreme Soviet last month. Today, Yeltsin met with the leaders of the parties and told them, hands off the Constitution. Stick to your political platforms or risk losing your free access to the airwaves. There has been practically no public debate about the new Constitution, which gives great power to the Russian president. Yeltsin's warning today would seem to be aimed at quashing any public discussion of the Constitution in order to assure a victory for Yeltsin in the referendum. The Communist Party is among those that have criticized the draft, but even some liberals have slammed Yeltsin for ramming the draft through without proper debate. I'm Mike Schuster in Moscow.
Machinists at United Airlines are still following their Work to the Rule campaign. United has not reported any delays from the job action. The machinists are protesting United's rejection of their joint offer with the pilots to buy a majority share of the company. Talks on the issue are continuing behind the scenes, and official negotiations are expected to resume in a few days. This is NPR News from Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest Michael Caine has made over 70 films in 30 years. He first established himself as a playboy in Alfie and as a crook-turned-secret agent in The Ipcress File. More recently, he won an Academy Award for Hannah and Her Sisters and starred in Dirty Rotten Scoundrels, Mona Lisa, Educating Rita, and Dressed to Kill. Of course, some of his 70 films were stinkers, like The Swarm, Jaws the Revenge, and Beyond the Poseidon Adventure. In his recent autobiography, What's It All About?, he tells his story from his birth in the charity ward of a hospital to his coming of age in a working-class neighborhood and his rise as a movie star. I spoke with him a year ago when the book was published. Caine has said that an actor's eyes are his most important asset. His voice is the second most important asset. Caine has one of the most distinctive voices in film.
Having a Cockney accent for a start was difficult. But also, it's where the voice was placed. Cockneys naturally talk. I'll try and get up there. It's right up in the throat here. It's rather like John Major, our Prime Minister. He talks like that. And the trick was to bring my voice down to the diaphragm, if you could imagine. If it's right up here in the throat, and then they bring it down a little bit further, like another one of our politicians who talks like that, and it's rather strangulated. But if you're going to boom out in the theatre without deafening the people at the front, you've got to be able to project your voice. And that was the most important thing that ever happened to me with my voice, which was it was placed. And the second thing was that over a period of years, I never went to the normal diction lessons that you had. British actors always spoke terribly like that, and they all spoke exactly the same because they all learned how to speak at RADA, the Royal Academy of Dramatic Art. And what happened to me is I worked on my own because I was never a trained actor, and I worked on my own voice. So what happened was, as I came out of it with a voice that was correctly placed by accident and a very, very individual accent. My accent is so individual that people who don't recognize me by sight, the minute I open my mouth, they know who I am.
Absolutely, absolutely. Now, did your Cockney accent stand in your way at all when you were first starting to make movies? Because England has a much more rigid class system,
sure,
in a way than America does, although we certainly have a class system here.
Yeah, well, you have a class system here, but you can't tell it by people's accents. In England, I can listen to a person and I'll tell you how much his house costs, how much he earns, what sort of car he drives after listening to him for 3 minutes. That's how defined by accent you are. Normally, in England, in the theatre when I came into it, there were no leading parts written for anybody in my natural accent. I always had to put on another accent. So in actual fact, from that point of view, it did hold me back a bit for a while.
Now, in the movie Dirty Rotten Scoundrels, which was made just a few years ago in the States, you and Steve Martin starred, and you were this really kind of upper-class, elegant womanizer who who came onto wealthy women and scammed them and took their money, whereas Steve Martin was a real kind of nickel and dime scam artist out for the same thing, wealthy women, and you taught him how to really do the more aristocratic version of it. What kind of accent did you use for that?
Well, that would be the British upper middle class accent. It was always the people, the upper middle class usually have the pretensions of the aristocrat without the class, and also the pretensions of the rich without the money. And so what you get is someone with absolutely no substance who is all front. And so you get a voice which is terribly like that, and it's very smooth and very, very slow.
My guest is actor Michael Caine. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. Actor Michael Caine is my guest. Now, another great role that I have to ask you about your voice in was in Mona Lisa, in which you played played a crime boss, a gangster.
Who, yes.
And Bob Hoskins played somebody who is kind of under you in there, and you were really intimidating him in your scenes in the film. It's a fantastic performance by you. Can you talk about how you used your voice in that? Because you needed to use it in a way that showed real authority and the willingness to intimidate and, if necessary, hurt somebody.
Yeah, authority is shown not only by voice but by movement. And what it is first thing in authority is you never move. Only people who are trying to attract your attention with no power move their hands. If you look at aristocracy and really powerful people, they move very little because everybody is awaiting their every word, wish, or command. And their voice is very, very slow because everybody will wait while they have their thought and wait no matter how long it takes for them to say what they're going to say. What you have to add in this case where I played a gangster, which would be menace. And menace would come if you were, I had a gangster accent, which is, again, a working-class Cockney accent, but there is a sort of cheerful, chirpy working-class sort of, hello, lads, let's all go down the pub and all this, you know, that sort of accent for the chirpy Cockney lad, cheerful little soul. But then there's another one, which is, it's kind of very drawn out. And it's very flat. And so they will actually say things to you. I mean, I grew up with gangsters like this. And they will say, I like you. And there's absolutely no emotion in the voice whatsoever. It's like an icicle. You know, they say, I think you're one of the nicest fellas I've ever met. Really do. I really think you're very nice. So, and then they say silly little things. When you know you're in trouble with a Cockney gangster, he'll say something like, well, who's been naughty then? Now, that question means you're probably going to get kneecapped to the floor. But it's one of those things of just flattening the voice out. The voice just flattens right out. No matter what you say, it just flattens.
Now, when you say you're in a position of power and authority, you don't move a lot.
No.
That means you don't blink a lot, too.
No. Oh, that's a trick for actors on film that I used and it was told. I think the first place I heard it was Marlene Dietrich who said it first, is that you don't blink. If you blink on camera, it signifies weakness. It's very difficult to do this trick on radio about blinking. But if you look in the mirror yourself, and just stare and start saying things to yourself, you'll see how powerful it is. And if you just blink once in the middle of it, you'll see how it all dissipates. It just dissipates the whole thing. And of course, if you're on a movie screen, you have to remember when you blink, each eyelid is somewhere between 2 to 7 feet wide. If you're in a close up.
That's a good point.
Yeah.
Well, how do you learn to not blink? It's hard to not blink. Your eyes start to hurt. You can do it for a little bit, but after a while, it's a real strain.
You just walk around. I walked around all my life. When I was a young lad, I wrote this about this in the book. When I was a young lad, I found a book in the public library, How to Teach Yourself Film Acting. And the first thing it said in it is, you must not blink. And so I walked around. I walked around this sort of working class district of London, which was used to some very rough people, you know, without blinking. And I looked like a sort of early serial killer. I'm sure I frightened the life out of people, because I used to have long conversations with people and never blink. And I would watch people getting hypnotized. And they would walk away from a quite simple conversation with me, quite flummoxed as to what went on.
Well, here's what I'm wondering, you know, since you learned, obviously, by making movies, how did you pick up everything that you know now about how to look into a camera, or how, like, where to look when the camera's looking at you? Did you pick that up over years after watching yourself?
No, I never watch myself. I never see rushes, and I only see the finished film once, just to see how it turned out and who goofed, including me. And, film is listening, reaction, and behavior. That's what film acting is. Shouldn't be called film acting at all, because it's not acting, it's something entirely. Acting is what you do on stage, as far as I'm concerned. And people behave. The only time real people act is if they're showing off or trying to make an impression, like a guy with a girl or something. Then they act, and then they're artificial, and we can all see they're artificial because they're acting. But normally, what you do is you listen, and you react, and then you behave, and that's all it is. You'll see actors, like, for instance, making gestures on the phone with no one there. You don't make gestures on the phone with no one there. You think you do, but you don't. And so you get sort of strange things happening like that when you see actors acting.
Mm-hmm. Now, but what about where to look when the camera's looking at you? I mean, you really learned how to work
Yes.
in front of a camera. And if you didn't spend a lot of time watching yourself, how did you learn that?
No, well, I learned by watching where the camera was. I mean, for instance, you always, if you're going to, the thing is, if you're going to play a part, you're playing a part with another actor, and you look in their eyes. And what you do, if you're acting, you suddenly go, well, how do I look into this person's eyes? Now, during your lifetime, you've looked into hundreds of people's eyes every time you speak to someone, but you can't remember how you did it. And what you do is you only look into one eye, because if you look into two eyes, you go cross-eyed. And the one eye you look into is the one that is nearest the camera, because that throws the one eye that you're not looking in, not using, straight into the lens.
Huh.
That's how you do that.
And how'd you learn that?
I figured it out. How to do it. I figured it out myself, actually. I figured out a lot of stuff myself, because you get a feeling in movies when you play someone, the actor should disappear and people should only see the person. I mean, it's a self-defeating thing in a funny way, because half the time people see me and they say, well, he's only playing himself. It's because I've made the actor disappear. And that's where you come down to this thing where you've got behavior and where you've got the camera. You can come down to the absolute minimum thing to do for the camera to pick up. And that's what's fascinating about film acting, because camera always finds it.
Michael Caine is my guest, and he's written a new autobiography called What's It All About? You were born, actually, not only working class, it was a really pretty poor family. You were born in the charity ward of the hospital. Your father was a porter at the fish market, your mother a cleaning woman. You spent several years in an apartment that had no electricity.
Yeah, I never lived in a house that had electricity until I was 12 years old,
mm-hmm.
which was in 1948.
So what did your friends think of your ambition to act?
Oh, they thought it was complete and utter, completely ridiculous, utterly derisory. I was just treated with absolute contempt by everybody, or ridicule.
No, why ridicule? I mean...
Because Well, for a start, people of my class and in that society never went into show business. No one knew anybody who was in show business or anything. And also, like my family, the male members of my family would regard any male going into show business or acting as being homosexual anyway, or a possible homosexual. There was a tremendous gay inference. I mean, we didn't use the word gay in those days. If you said, when I said to my father I was going to be an actor, it was the equivalent of telling him I was a homosexual as far as he was concerned.
So did you feel that you had to do things to prove your manhood while studying acting?
No, I was already doing those, but my father didn't know about it.
but I think I get what you're saying.
Yes. But I really had to prove to him. I married very young, which I sometimes think was an effort to prove to him that I wasn't gay. And I had a child when I was 22. I had a daughter when I was 22. And of course, with his simple-minded way of looking at it, he was again wrong, because the fact that I was married and had a baby meant to him that I was definitely not a homosexual. And so he was wrong in both cases, you know, because there are a lot of people who are married with children who are homosexuals. But he had a very simplistic view of the world.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he was a very, very tough man. I mean, and it's very hard to put across to anybody, to get across to anybody just how tough he was. Back again to the gay analogy, he actually thought that any man who ate chicken was gay.
Chicken?
Yes.
Why?
Because this red meat thing, you know, real men ate red meat and all this stuff, and he thought that was sissy food, chicken.
Did he ever come see you in a performance or
no.
See your movies?
No. No, he died. He died when I was completely out of work, completely broke. He died of cancer when he was 56 years old. One of my great regrets in my life is that his last memories of me was as a complete and utter disaster and failure. But at least he knew I wasn't gay because I had a wife and a child.
Right. Michael Caine recorded 1 year ago. His memoir, What's It All About, will be published in paperback in January. This is Fresh Air.
Hello, this is Noah Adams in Washington. Coming up later in All Things Considered, we'll have a conversation with Donald Hall, a poet who lives in Wilmot, New Hampshire. We'll hear some of his poetry and talk with him about his goals in writing poetry, also about writing while coming out of depression. And in Texas, cloned Christmas trees, Virginia pine trees, perfect trees being replicated there to increase the marketability rate of Christmas trees. And we'll meet two young men in Washington, D.C., who've opened a brand new restaurant called Delights of the Garden. They own food processors, but not an oven, and the reason for that is everything in their restaurant is served raw. Those stories and the news coming up later on All Things Considered from National Public Radio.
From time to time, writer Annie Lamott joins us with some thoughts on the life she shares with her young son, Sam. She's raising him on her own, with help from her extended family and friends. Her dear friend Pammy, who is very close with Sam, died a year ago this month.
The night before the one-year anniversary of my best friend Pammy's death, Sam was on a tear, willful and crazed. It wasn't like him. When I stuck him in his room for a time out, he said calmly, "Mom, I can't love you." I smiled. A minute later, he started crying. I asked him what was wrong. "I'm mad at God," he said, "because he took Pammy away." Pammy and I were best friends for 25 years. She was helping me raise Sam. We were supposed to watch our kids grow up together. This was the meal plan I had selected. "I'm mad too," I said. The next day, Sam and I went to visit a yew tree that has been planted in Pammy's memory at the radiation clinic where she received treatment. I thought we could spend a few minutes of silence in the garden where the yew was planted, maybe talk about heaven a little. Sam's got a fairly active religious life for a 4-year-old. He goes to a little Christian preschool where he sings along more passionately than anyone else, although he still can't say his L's, so he sings, "Good morning, Yord," at the top of his lungs, and even more jovially, "Oh, the Yord is good to me." So we were in this little garden, a steamy little enclosure with no ceilings, filled with dark, rich earth and healing plants, ferns, flowers, vines, a rock fountain that trickled the loveliest stream of water, and Pammy's yew. I told Sam he couldn't play in the dirt because this wasn't that kind of garden. He looked at me askance. I showed him Pammy's yew. It was about a foot taller than I am, fuzzy and comical and friendly, like a cross between Barney the dinosaur and an Edward Corrin cartoon. It looked like it might suddenly hug you. "Why did Pammy die again?" Sam asked. The rock fountain was so soft and melodious and feminine that it sounded like deer were drinking from it. In the distance, you could hear traffic and the hum of machines, but you mostly heard the fountain. So it was very centering, what psychiatrists would call a cognitive centering device, but it was also about flow, which is something we're allowed to talk about in California. Fear is the stuck, if you ask me, and water is the flow. "Well," I said, "she died because she got too sick and her body didn't work anymore, like when Uncle Steve's old car broke down." "Did she fly home then?" he asked. I was silent for a moment. I wanted to ask, "Honey, are you channeling again?" Sometimes I wonder if he has memories of before he was born or even conceived, if that's what he means by home, if the earth is an odd distant place he's just visiting. "Yes," I answered, "I think she flew home." Then he started being awful again, like the night before, as if channeling a spirit named Hunk Joe Bob. "We are leaving this second," he announced, as if in the next sentence he would call me woman. I wasn't ready to go. I wanted to think about something a doctor told me 6 months before Pammy died. She said, "Watch her closely right now because she's teaching you how to live." And Pammy did do this. I miss her every day, like you would miss the ocean if you moved inland after a lifetime on the beach. But my life is the best it's ever been because she taught me to live as if you're dying. But Sam didn't want to hang out in the beautifully composed garden, filled with its healing herbs, dark, rich earth you couldn't dig in, memories, and Pammy's yew tree. He didn't feel the presence of the Yord in there. He needed to be outside, breathing fresh air, making lots of noise and mess, in real dirt you could play in. So we left. I figure, who knows? Maybe he's on to something.
Annie Lamott is the author of Operating Instructions, a journal of my son's first year. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Richard Parker, Joyce Lieberman, Ron Barron, and Chris Fraley. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Naomi Person directed the show. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, the adventures of a homeless writer and his dog. We talk with Lars Einer. His new book, Travels with Lisbeth, is about his 3 years on the road and on the streets. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.